Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, believing growth of Florida's economy depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust works with the business community to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital team members. More information is at abletrust.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
Local and state government leaders are frequently butting heads in Florida, but there seems one thing the two sides can agree on.
We have three branches, we have three levels. All of us stay in our lanes, good things happen. And when you get outside those lanes, behavior becomes that egregious.
Also this week, Governor Rick Scott wants doctors to use a drug monitoring database. That would mark a big turnaround for a lawmaker who originally tried to defund the program because it was ineffective.
Well, it's not working because it hadn't been implemented yet. Did not get implemented until the September after he was in office.
We'll also learn about how the sudden resignation of a state lawmaker has legislative leadership cracking down on sexual harassment at the Capitol. And we'll look at how the state's struggling to deal with the high turnover rate of its child abuse investigators. I'm Tom Flanagan. This is Capitol Report. Local government leaders and members of the Florida House appear to be drawing their battle lines in advance of the upcoming legislative session, and we get that story from Regan McCarthy.
Florida House Speaker Richard Corcoran recently announced his chamber has filed a lawsuit against the city of Tampa for what he calls an illegal tax.
They have no authority to do that. Local and city governments can not raise a single tax outside of ad valorem. It's basically 100% a state jurisdiction. They'd have to come and get permission from the state, as they did to get the original bed tax and the cap at 5%. They didn't do that. They've called it a special assessment. If it looks like a duck and quacks like a duck, it's a duck. This is it looks like a tax. It spends like a tax. It's collected like a tax. It's absolutely a tax.
Under Corcoran's leadership, the House of Representatives has developed a reputation for going after local governments. But Corcoran says his chamber is simply working to increase accountability and cut out abuse. He says city and county governments should stay in their lanes.
We have three branches. We have three levels. All of us stay in our lanes, good things happen. And when you get outside those lanes, behavior becomes that egregious.
It's an argument Florida League of Cities President Gil Ziffer and outgoing National Association of Counties President Brian DeLoge would seem to agree with.
I tell you, there's a place for local government, cities, county schools, and there's a place for the state, and there's a place for the federal government. I testified at the Capitol about a month ago in front of Ryan and Pelosi on intergovernmental, coordination effectively. And we talked about that. I mean, everybody plays a role, but it's as Gil said earlier, you stay in your swim lane and hopefully you do that. And we have some desperate needs for state regulations in some areas, but they're overstep their boundary in our opinion.
What the local government leaders and the House Speaker seem to disagree on is where the lines for those lanes should be drawn. Ziffer says the question seems to come down to perception.
And unfortunately, more from the House side, there is and it's been publicly stated by many in leadership and leadership to come that most of our large cities are blue. They're at least from a perception standpoint, lean more on the Democratic side, even though we're nonpartisan. And the state legislature is not. It's more red, particularly our leadership. And as a result of that, there is, I think, a general effort, and it's been spoken by them, to dictate down because they know better. And that's getting out of that lane that we keep talking about, staying in your lanes.
Ziffer says when state lawmakers attempt to dictate how local government should operate, it takes away the ability of local leaders to make decisions that best reflect or support the character of the individual communities they lead.
Whether it's your big believer in being near the coast, or maybe it's culture and the arts, or maybe it's something else, but you move to that city or that county because it's what you like, which makes us different, which is why it's important for everybody, once again, to stay in their lanes, because not all cities are created the same. They're different, and that's why people move to different areas. We want to be able to maintain that individuality, and the only way to do that, whether you want to call it home rule or local control or whatever, two words, three words you want to put together, but it's democracy at its very basic level, which is on a local level. And that's what we need to maintain. And sometimes some leadership, particularly on the House side, is coming after us to remove that ability. And we're going to fight it.
And Deloge says often the state's efforts to control local governments come in the form of controlling local government spending.
And at the state level around the country, you see a lot of what's happening where they limit the amount of local government's ability to raise any kind of taxes, and then they basically – the downside and the upside. They take away our revenue and they limit our income effectively, or take away our ability to expense.
But Corcoran says that's not his concern, as long as everybody – you guessed it – stays in their lanes.
I'm fine with giving local government in their lane. Here's all of your revenue sources. You can spend them how you want.
In the same press conference where he discussed his lawsuit, Corcoran also touted a bill that would create new rules for local economic development organizations and tourism development councils. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
The governor and state lawmakers are proposing new prescription limits to fight opioid abuse, but they also want to require physicians to use a long-standing drug monitoring database, and that raises the question, why wasn't it mandatory to begin with? Nick Evans takes a look at that question and its possible answer.
Late last month, Fort Myers Republican Senator Lisbeth Beniquisto released a couple of videos on YouTube, raising awareness for her opioid measure. The videos feature parents who've lost children, healthcare workers, and law enforcement.
The best way to combat this issue is to make sure that we limit the amount prescribed to a person.
That's Lee County Undersheriff Carmine Marcino highlighting Beniquisto's top policy change. But she and her House partner, Republican Jim Boyd, are taking a different tack as well, requiring doctors to use a database tracking controlled substances. This is Stewart's Pharmacy in Tallahassee. Whenever someone shows up with a prescription for opioids, Danny Jackson looks them up on the Prescription Drug Monitoring Program, or PDMP. Unlike doctors, it's been mandatory for pharmacists to use the database for years. I asked him what turns up for me. Right away, he saw I used to live in California. I moved to Florida a little over 5 years ago.
I mean, I can see any controlled substances that you've gotten in the state of Florida recently. Anything you have in California, I cannot see. Any regular prescriptions, I cannot see.
Right.
So
right.
You have no drug data coming up on your when I did a name search for you.
Jackson runs a compounding pharmacy, and he explains he doesn't see many prescriptions for controlled substances. But when he does, he looks for the sorts of things you might expect. Numerous doctors, multiple pharmacies, or frequent refills could all be red flags. Jackson says the database is an effective tool for determining whether to fill an order, and he believes doctors should be using it too.
If the doctor would use it, it would stop the prescription being, abused in the first place.
We're going to fight to require mandatory use of the Florida Prescription Drug Monitoring Program, a database that monitors controlled substances and helps healthcare workers make informed decisions before prescribing medicine to their patients.
That's Governor Rick Scott speaking in September at an event laying out his ideas for opioid reform. Beniquisto and Boyd's bills mirror his proposals. But the new requirements are a significant departure for the governor.
My name is Mike Fasano. I'm the tax collector for Pasco County here in Florida. Prior to being the tax collector in Florida, I was a state senator for 10 years and a state house member for Florida for 9 years.
Fasano spent a significant amount of his time at the Capitol championing the PDMP, and his effort was instrumental in getting it approved.
This piece of legislation that we finally got passed took almost 10 years. It was an idea of Governor Bush and his Office of Drug Control and Drug Czar back then.
By the time Fasano's bill gained approval, it was Governor Charlie Crist who signed off on the measure. And even he was on his way out the door. His replacement was an outsider named Rick Scott, a former healthcare executive promising jobs for a state racked by the Great Recession.
When Governor Scott proposed his first budget after he first got elected, in the budget, he abolishes two things. He abolishes the Prescription Drug Monitoring Program, and he abolishes the Office of Drug Control in the governor's office. And we didn't understand why. And a reporter asked the governor, Scott, why did you do away with the PDMP? And he said, well, it's not working. Well, it's not working because it hadn't been implemented yet.
At a recent cabinet meeting, Governor Scott was evasive about what prompted the change of heart.
Well, we are where we are, and we're going to constantly try to get better and deal with these issues. We have a significant issue with opioids. I'm going to do everything I can to try to stop it. We've done an emergency order.
In a follow-up statement, Scott's staff pointed to concerns about privacy and legislation he's signed into law since bolstering database security. Scott expressed similar concerns to a congressional panel in 2011, too. Governor Crist, who signed the PDMP into law back in 2010, explains privacy was a big hurdle for the bill to clear on its way to his desk.
So I think the legislature wanted to be sensitive to that, yet still be able to find a way that this kind of data could be utilized positively in order to keep the people of Florida safe.
Protecting doctor-patient privacy is part of why physicians aren't mandated to use the PDMP. But the prescribing decisions doctors make for their patients still wind up on the database. Choosing not to consult it just means some physicians make the decision with less information. For his part, Fasano believes security concerns like hacking are a bit overblown, and he applauds the governor and state lawmakers' proposals. He says it's critical to get doctors involved.
Look, it can all be stopped at the doctor's office. Let's be realistic about this. A prescription can only be filled if a doctor writes it. So when people say, how did this all begin? How did this all start? It started because a prescription was written.
For Florida Public Radio, I'm Nick Evans.
With the start of the 2018 Florida lawmaking session more than 2 months away, House members, mostly Republicans, have pitched 114 projects and programs for state money. The proposals range from $30,000 for the Okaloosa County Historical Museum to $2 million for coastal work in Jacksonville Beach to $300,000 for drainage improvements in Miami Gardens. House Majority Leader Ray Rodriguez, who is vice chair of the House Select Committee on Hurricane Response and Preparedness, said priority will be given to projects that could be linked to Hurricane Irma relief or to brace for future disasters. The House budget proposals for the 2018 session, which starts January 9th, by the way, mark your calendar, totaled $117 million as of this morning. The House, unlike the Senate, requires members to file separate bills for proposed spending projects. Lawmakers face a tight budget going into the session, in part because of costs related to Hurricane Irma. But Governor Rick Scott said this week the state has enough money to pay for priorities without having to dip into reserves. Still to come on Capitol Report, word of a high-ranking state lawmaker's affair with a lobbyist as legislative leadership cracking down on cases where members may be flirting with sexual harassment situations.
What we want to do is make sure that every member of the staff, every senator knows that we have zero tolerance.
Florida's Child Welfare Agency is looking for ways to deal with high turnover of its investigators who look into child abuse cases.
We have a real need in the department to get folks to stay at least to the two-year mark, because we've determined that if we can hire you and we can train you and you can do this work and do it fairly well for 2 years, we've gotten our money's worth.
And Florida finds itself a haven for Puerto Rican college students who can no longer pursue their education at home.
I took a hot shower and I started to cry because of everything that we had over here and they didn't have over there.
One event that is eagerly awaited by Tallahassee's Capitol Press Corps each year is something called AP Day, the AP standing for Associated Press, which sponsors the occasion. It always takes place in advance of the legislative session and gives reporters a chance to hang out with the governor and House and Senate leadership and kind of get an idea of how the session might play out. An added bonus this year, was having several candidates for governor on hand because of next year's election. It's kind of like a big news buffet for reporters. But something that happened a week ago today was also a hot topic at this year's AP Day at the Capitol. You may recall right here on Capitol Report, we told you about the sudden resignation of Democratic State Senator Jeff Clemons. He stepped down after admitting to having an extramarital affair with a county government lobbyist. Well, Senate President Joe Negron insisted Thursday during AP Day that he has a zero-tolerance policy towards sexual harassment and is working to strengthen his chamber's rules to make it easier for workers to complain if they've been mistreated. That was the first time Negron had spoken publicly since Clemons resigned last Friday. Negron had drawn fire over the weekend for changing how the Senate handles sexual harassment complaints. The revised procedure appeared to block victims from lodging complaints with Human Resources. But Negron on Thursday reiterated that the new process was intended to give individuals more, not fewer, outlets for help.
I don't think it would be appropriate or founded to say, in the absence of complaints, there must be complaints. I think that what we want to do is make sure that every member of the staff, every senator knows that we have zero tolerance.
Under the new rule, workers are supposed to report allegations of sexual harassment to their immediate supervisor, the Senate Chief of Staff, or the Senate President. Meanwhile, in the House, Majority Leader Ray Rodriguez says all elected officials need to remember that constituents expect them to have high ethical standards.
I don't think an elected official should be using their position that they have, which is one of power, over anyone who would be in a subordinate position to them, whether that's a staff member who reports to them or a lobbyist whose livelihood depends on the actions that the legislator is going to take.
Now, Florida Senate Democrats will be voting next week on a replacement for Clemons, who was slated to take over as caucus leader after the 2018 elections. His Senate seat will be filled in a special election, which has yet to be scheduled. With the 2018 legislative session around the corner, Florida lawmakers, as well as child welfare stakeholders, are starting to dive into how to address the huge turnover of the state's child protective investigators. As Sasha Cordner reports, their job is to look into cases called into the state's child abuse hotline.
Yeah, there's definitely stressful days, and And there are some cases that still bother you.
That's Jennifer Renfro, a senior child protective investigator for the Florida Department of Children and Families. As she heads to her next case, she recalls one involving an 8-year-old child from years ago.
We received a report, and this child, straight-A student, sweet child, she disclosed a lot of, I would call it torture, as far as they would make her drink hot sauce and hold her nose and dump water on her head and make her go to bed wet. They told her they hated her. We ended up removing her and her little brother.
Renfro says what she found most shocking was the abused girl still loved her parents and wanted to see them. Renfro's testimony is one of the videos featured on DCS YouTube channel about the day in the life of a child protective investigator. Over the years, that position has seen high turnover, in part, Jessica Price says, because some who leave say they never really understood what they were getting into. Price heads the Florida Institute for Child Welfare, created by the Florida legislature in 2014, to conduct research and analyze Florida's child protection and child welfare services. To help address the turnover within DCF, Price suggests what she calls realistic job previews.
They generally are videos that are shown to applicants that are interested in going into child welfare work. On these previews, you have caseworkers that are discussing their job in a very candid way, in a very real way. The realistic job previews that I have seen sometimes show caseworkers going into certain neighborhoods. Like, sometimes the previews show that their jobs start in the middle of the night.
Florida lawmakers have begun discussing some ideas of their own. St. John's Republican Representative Cindy Stevenson recommends shadowing.
Shadowing is one of the best things I shouted, I wanted to be a veterinarian. I found out I really didn't like the smell of blood. You know, saved me a lot of money. So I really, in addition to like that realistic, you know, video, if you can get a shadowing experience, that seems like it would really help because it's a big investment of time.
At least one lawmaker suggested higher pay for child protective investigators, but DCF Secretary Mike Carroll says that's not really the main issue.
Pay is somewhat a factor when we think about pay, but I can tell you most of the folks that I talk to don't mention pay. They mention workload and they mention, you know, their perceived lack of support in that workload because they lose control and of their ability to control their life and they can't control their work life.
So what does the head of DCF himself suggest to address the issue? Carroll says he's looking at the long term rather than the short term. He says first he wants to make sure those they train stay past the 2-year mark. Most new hires are in their 20s and 30s, and Carroll says this is often their first job. He says after doing a survey, many spoke to a lack of mentorship. So under a new policy, senior child protective investigators will now be mentoring lower-level investigators.
We also created child protective investigator field supervisors. We understand that one of the things that is going to be crucial going forward to keeping folks in these jobs is not the classroom training we do, because we're pretty successful with the classroom training. It's the support that we give folks when they get out to the field.
Andy says his ultimate goal is for the investigators to have a manageable caseload while maintaining a personal life as well.
I do believe that any recommendation that we have for keeping folks in the workforce is to provide work-life balance and to restructure this work in a way where folks have time off that's theirs. You know, you should have a weekend where you actually have a weekend, not where you're tethered to a telephone and you thought you had a weekend, but now on a Saturday afternoon you're out in the middle of an investigation and your family's someplace else. We have to find a way to structure the way we do this work in a way that would provide that work-life balance, because that's what the folks in the field are asking us about.
The House committee that looks into children issues has made addressing the turnover one of its legislative priorities. Meanwhile, on Thursday, Governor Rick Scott announced his support for spending $10 million to hire 130 additional child protective investigators and Ford Abuse Hotline counselors. In a statement, DCF Chief Carroll says hiring additional investigators will allow DCF to keep the caseloads low so that it will provide that work-life balance. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Kortner.
Florida lawmakers are going to be back in the Capitol on Monday for a series of committee meetings. All this, of course, in preparation for the 2018 session. Among the issues they're going to be debating during the week, a House proposal to repeal the no-fault automobile insurance system. Also next week, death row inmate Patrick Hannon is scheduled to be executed in connection with a pair of 1991 murders in Hillsborough County. You're listening to Capitol Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, universities in South Florida are working to help Puerto Ricans affected by Hurricane Maria to continue their education. Some students have already taken advantage of discounts and other incentives. But as we hear from Jessica Bateman at member station WLRN in Miami, some students are going through a rough transition.
Ana Isabel Escobar couldn't reach her family for 2 days after Hurricane Maria hit Puerto Rico.
It was nerve-wracking because I talk with my parents every day. I mean, we have a group message. We use Bitmojis. We're that type of family.
Her mom and dad were in Guaynabo near San Juan. She was in Boca Raton, where she's a freshman at Florida Atlantic University. She's one of about a dozen students there who's getting a tuition break this semester. The school offered in-state rates to Puerto Ricans because of the hurricane. Even for Ana, who'd begun classes here in Florida about a month before the storm. Like she said, she's close with her folks. So much so that when they heard about our interview, they asked her to film it for them on her phone.
Okay, go ahead.
Hi, Mom and Dad.
Hi.
Ana has a map of the world on the wall of her dorm room. She's written all over it in marker. She noted the only Spanish-speaking country in Africa, Equatorial Guinea. Hawaii is marked to do. There's a circle around Puerto Rico and the word home with a heart. She constantly feels the pull of the island and the guilt of being far away.
Sometimes I'm like sitting down and I'm like, I should be there, but at the same time, okay, maybe I'm here because eventually I'm going to help in a bigger portion of what's happening home.
Here is like our mini living room, kind of.
Two college freshmen are giving me a tour of their dorm suite at St. Thomas University in Miami Gardens. They've known each other for a week, but already they're all giggles and they finish each other's sentences. On their door, there are two blue letters.
So this LA, that stands for your initials?
Yeah, it's Leishla, that's my name, and Ari or Aranza.
Aranza, yeah.
So this is our room.
They started college in Puerto Rico, but Hurricane Maria closed their schools. St. Thomas is offering free room and board through the spring, so they moved to Miami. Leishla Acevedo from Canovanas and Aranza Mendez from Guaynabo. Since they got here, they've experienced an intense range of emotions. Mostly, they too have been buried in guilt. This is Leishla.
I came over here to my cousin's house, so I turned on the lights and I started to cry. And then I took a hot shower and I started to cry because of everything that we had over here and they didn't have over there.
They recount for me the horrific experience of living through the hurricane. They both tell me leaving the island was the hardest decision they've ever made. They're headed home soon for Thanksgiving. Leishla says she doubts they'll have the usual feast.
We're used to like eating turkey like the whole 2 weeks after Thanksgiving. So we eat like turkey sandwiches, turkey with rice, turkey with everything. So that's going to be hard.
Leishla notices her roommate start to cry and gives her a hug. Another student, Mario Nieves, listens, subtly wiping away tears. More than 60 students from Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands have come to St. Thomas University since the storm.
And that's like a big family because maybe we don't know their names, but we feel like we have known each other for years.
Yeah, we're all in the same boat.
Yeah.
Mario's a senior, and he'd already missed months of school because of a strike at his university. Maria flooded his father's hardware store, destroying merchandise and machinery. His grandmother is without power and water. She got sick and was rushed to the emergency room. He says, yeah, leaving was tough. He insists I see his new dorm room, where Puerto Rican flags hang above his bed and his roommates.
I came with Puerto Rico. I have Puerto Rico inside of me. And that's something that we Boricuas never change.
Communications have been spotty in his hometown, Trujillo Alto. But the other day, he got a message. His grandma is feeling better. I'm Jessica Bakeman in Miami.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Sasha Cordner, Nick Evans, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, and Kate Payne. We also thank our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FPR Cap Report. And join us again next week at this time for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, dedicated to connecting businesses and workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to recruit, interview, and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. Abletrust.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.